Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 8.
To be sure, the theory of forms is itself open to a variety of objections. Plato's the first to mention many of them. In the dialogues named The Sophist and the Parmenides, Plato describes the most fundamental problems. Exactly what is the relation between the universal forms and particular things? What's the relation of the forms to each other? Do the forms themselves have the same qualities of which they are forms? For example, is redness red, or courage courageous? Furthermore, do forms exist for all things and properties, including those which can hardly be perfect, like mud or errors? These aren't merely quibbles. If the forms do exist, we should be able to describe their relations to each other, to what they are not, and most of all, to themselves. Plato proposes answers to most of these questions, although even he's not entirely satisfied with those answers. Many of the philosophers who followed him find them even more unsatisfactory. Notwithstanding, Plato remains firm in his commitment to the theory of forms, if only because he foresees even greater difficulties in trying to understand experience without them. So in this dialogue, we hear Socrates expressing his agreement with the older philosopher Parmenides.
If, in view of all these difficulties, and others like them, a man refuses to admit that forms of things exist, or to distinguish a definite form in every case, he will have nothing on which to fix his thought, so long as he will not allow that each thing has a character that is always the same. In so doing, he will completely destroy the significance of all discourse.
In committing himself to the theory of forms, then, Plato contends that genuine knowledge, as opposed to mere opinion or belief, is indeed possible. Knowledge is possible mainly because sometimes it's indeed actual. Not only are there times when we know, but there are times when we know that we know. When we know, we are not mistaken. Once this claim is granted, the forms, in Plato's view, are required to explain it. Without them, our knowledge and the existence of what is known could not be accounted for. Philosophers since Plato, beginning with his own student, Aristotle, have almost continuously discussed and quarreled about the theory of forms, often proposing other theories to replace it. But the alternatives proposed have often had more of Plato in them than their authors would admit. This was true, for example, even of Aristotle's dissenting view, when he wondered what practical use the theory of forms had. Where the objections to Plato or Platonism are strongest, the theories proposed as replacements encounter other difficulties, almost always as serious as the objections raised in the first place. Here, too, even in opposition, philosophy after Plato has stood constantly in his shadow. Although the theory of forms has certain abstract assumptions and consequences, Plato constantly reminds us that the evidence for the existence of the forms is very much present in the world of everyday experience. The forms provide a way to understand the differences among types of knowledge and between true and false values. They also serve as a basis for pursuing some values and rejecting others. In other words, knowledge is not something apart from the decisions that human beings make. Knowledge, in fact, provides the basis for making those decisions. Nor are Plato's concepts of knowledge and reason mere abstractions or theories. The impulse for the examined life, for learning, is, according to Plato, innate in man. The urge to know is a constant feature of human nature. Even when people don't act rationally, reason is still present. It's only been prevented by other causes from expressing itself. Sometimes, as we've seen, the emotions or senses imprison reason. One memorable example of this constant presence of reason appears in Plato's concept of love or desire, in Greek, eros. If we ask, as so many people have, what love is, Plato's answer is that love is also the guise taken on by the impulse for wisdom, for philosophical knowledge. Desire, once we go below the surface of its appearance, is actually a desire for truth. At least Plato claims this in the much-admired dialogue entitled The Symposium. In The Symposium, Plato describes a festive gathering, a drinking party at which the guests, as part of the entertainment, give speeches in praise of love. These speeches form a pattern. First, Phaedrus and Pausanias speak about the relation between the lover and his beloved. For Phaedrus, the lover is to be praised most of all, since the lover is willing to sacrifice everything for love. Pausanias, on the other hand, extols the beloved as superior. He says that the beloved responds to love even when he knows that the lover may be deceitful or moved by base motives.
If anyone devotes himself to the service of another in the belief that through him he will acquire wisdom or any other virtue, this willing servitude is not base. There is no shame either in being disappointed of such hopes. But any other kind of lover's hope, whether it comes true or not, is shameful.
The physician Eryximachus then provides a more clinical view. Love, he reports, is the harmony between violent desires and a more divine and gentler impulse. When the gentler impulse rules, it brings true happiness and friendship.
When love brings together all the opposites, it unites them in an ordered harmony. The result is health and plenty for mankind, and for the animal and vegetable kingdoms as well.
The writer of comedies, Aristophanes, then gives a comic account of love's passion. People were first created, Aristophanes explains, as beings in whom the two sexes were combined. Soon after their creation, however, those first creatures were split in half by the gods. The result of that split now is the passion we find as each one of those halves goes around in a constant search for the other half. Aristophanes describes this view of love.
So you see, gentlemen, how far back we can trace our innate love for one another, and how this love is always trying to reintegrate our former nature, to make two into one, and to bridge the gulf between one human being and another.
The first several speeches at the party thus refer to love only between people. Agathon, who speaks next, feels that the level of the discussion needs to be raised. In his speech, then, he describes love as a god, the source of beauty and of good.
Of all gods and men, an ornament, a guide most beautiful and best.
Agathon wants here to portray love as more than human. But in order to make his point, he goes to the other extreme, presenting love as divine only and not human at all. Socrates, speaking last, must bring Agathon and the discussion down to earth, at least part of the way. So Socrates points out to the assembly that love can't be beauty or goodness in themselves. The reason for this is that love is always love of something. And that means that love could occur only when there is a need or lack which the lover wants to satisfy. The desire for something, even for beauty or good, implies that the person who has that desire does not already have that good. Since if he had it, he wouldn't want it. This proves, in Socrates' view, that love can't itself be a god, since the gods lack for nothing. Socrates quotes a speech he once heard from a prophet, Diotima, about the origins of love. According to Diotima, the parents of love were need and plenty. The characters of those two parents then combine in their offspring, producing desire, which then propels love wherever it appears. So Socrates remembers Diotima's words.
As the son of plenty and need, love is always needy. Nor is he delicate and lovely, as most of us believe. But on the one hand, he is harsh and acid, always partaking of his mother's poverty. But then, too, on the other hand, he partakes of his father's plenty in his designs upon the beautiful and the good, for he is gallant, impetuous, a mighty hunter.
Desire begins first at the level of the senses, in the body's attraction to physical beauty, but that beauty is restricted. It's an incitement for something more. Desire moves further by pursuing the beauty which is common to individual physical bodies and which is, accordingly, not itself physical. Thus, desire leads upward towards the form of beauty, a form present first in bodies, but more fully in souls and in knowledge. Finally, if the lover continues this ascent, he's rewarded with a view of beauty itself in perfect simplicity. Love, then, is distinctively human. The gods, because they have everything, don't need it. Creatures who are less than human are incapable of it. And all human beings are moved by love, whether they realize it or not. Anyone may stop at any of love's stages, including the first stage of the senses, but the desire that people experience is pointed beyond the senses, even if they don't always recognize this. The ideal of platonic love is not physical love. It's not even love of a particular person. It is love of the form of beauty, which is ideal, eternal, and real. Diotima had described to Socrates this type of love.
If man's life is even worth the living, it is when he has attained this vision of the very core of beauty. And once you have seen it, you will care nothing for the beauties that used to take your breath away and kindle such a longing in you. For then you would see true beauty face to face.
Socrates' description of love is evidence that what is human is also related to the divine. With this flurry, Socrates completes his retelling of the story that Diotima had first told him. Just when Socrates finishes speaking, the party is rudely interrupted by a number of new arrivals. Alcibiades, already drunk, enters and delivers an impromptu speech in praise of Socrates, whom he'd once tried to attract as a lover. Alcibiades lauds Socrates especially for his ability to resist both the temptations and the weaknesses of the senses. So he shouts out,
"Fill up, Socrates, drink again. Not that you'll get any change out of him. It doesn't matter how much you give him, it never makes him drunk. It was the same when we once were in a battle together, and when we were once cut off from supplies. There was no one who put such a good face on it as he."
The party goes on, first noisily, with carousing, then gradually, as time passes, it quiets down. As with many drinking parties, some of the people fall asleep, some go home. Late in the night, Socrates is heard explaining to Aristophanes and Agathon that tragedy and comedy are closely related to each other. In fact, Socrates says the writer of tragedy will also be the writer of comedy, perhaps referring here to some of Plato's own writing. The dialogue, the symposium itself, ends as dawn breaks. Aristophanes and Agathon have also, finally, fallen asleep. Socrates alone seems unaffected by the hour or the drinking, as the narrator of the dialogue tells us.
After tucking up Aristophanes and Agathon, Socrates went on his way. He stopped at the Lyceum for a bath, and then spent the rest of the day as usual.
In this way, Socrates, known even among his friends for his homely looks, has the last word on the nature of beauty. So too, Plato and Socrates come together here, as elsewhere, in their lives and thought. Plato writes philosophical dialogues as both comedy and tragedy. Socrates, the leading figure in those dialogues, represents the life of philosophy. This philosophical life occurs between the everyday world of appearance and the world of reason or mind. Although the world of reason may sometimes be less evident than the world of appearance, it is still more real than that world. There is, quite simply, no way to avoid reason, at least for human beings. The questions raised by philosophy, Plato insists, are constantly before us, whether we want to face them or not. There's no way of escaping those questions. There's no way of putting an end to them. Not in any event, as long as we remain human rather than gods. So too, philosophy, which begins in wonder, also continues in wonder. And we are ever reminded of this by the way that Plato's dialogues lead us to ask not only Plato's questions, but our own as well.
This concludes The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston.